Kathy Dello here to talk about how our local ecosystems are being affected, as well as talk about climate adoption and resiliency. If you could save your questions for after Kathy's remarks, she has about 45 or 50-minute presentation. Then we'll do a Q&A with everyone. We'll run a microphone around and get your questions answered. And then she's going to hang out a few minutes after the presentation as well, if you have individual questions. Kathy is the Deputy Director of the Oregon Climate Service, which serves as the State Climate Office for Oregon. She works on climate impact analysis, climate adaptation, and public outreach for the Oregon Climate Change Research Institute and the Climate Impacts Research Consortium. She coordinated Oregon's first climate assessment report, which is required under the legislation which created that institute. She has a bachelor's in atmospheric science and a master's in physical geography from the University at Albany, State University of New York. Please welcome Kathy Dello.
Thanks, Zach. I am from New York, and sometimes I marvel about how my life has changed, and I'm standing in a brewery in Oregon in a spotlight, and I never thought I'd be 5 years ago. I'm going to talk a little bit about climate change, how it's affecting Oregon, a little bit about climate adaptation, maybe some hope for resiliency. Can you hear me? Okay. And a little bit about this winter, because I get tons of questions, what's going on? So it is Mardi Gras. Normally I would use slides from Oregon for this, but I'm using New Orleans in honor of the day, so drink up. The difference between weather and climate is crucial. We have to understand that before we move on, and it's hard sometimes to explain the difference to people, but weather is kind of the here and now. If I say it's raining in Bend or it's partly sunny in New Orleans for the parades, that's the weather. But when I'm talking about an average or an aggregate at a certain place over a time, then that's the climate. So when it snows in Washington, D.C., and someone says, well, that means climate change isn't happening, that's just one weather event. When we talk about climate, we're talking about this overall record averaged over a place, averaged over at least a 30-year span. Backward. This should come as no surprise to anybody. Part of the state is wet, and part of the state is pretty dry. We're over here in the dry side, and the Cascade Mountains act as a barrier, this is getting my way, and create a rain shadow effect. And I've heard that the Cascades rain shadow is one of the best in the world in that it just cuts off. The difference in precipitation between somewhere like Eugene and Redmond is astounding. But right here, sorry, I'm getting the hang of this. Down here in the Steens Mountains, they get quite a bit of precip. Up here in the Blue and Wallawa Mountains, Willamette Valley, and this is probably one of the wettest spots in Oregon, along here with down by Brookings. And the global mean temperature record over land and ocean, you can see an overall trend of an increase in temperature over the past decade, not decade, century. And I get a lot of questions, well, what about this? Are we cooling? Are we leveling off? I heard we're going back into a cooling phase. If you start and you look at the trend here from 1998, which was a strong El Nino year, and you draw the line down, you will have a declining trend. But you wouldn't look at that as a declining trend or just that as an upward trend. You need to look at the overall picture. And I've been asked a question a lot of times about cities contributing to this, and if you took out the cities and just looked at rural stations, you'd still get an upward trend. And this is what the trends have looked like in the Pacific Northwest in the past century. A red dot means that it's been an increasing temperature trend, and these are stations all around the Northwest. This is a tool on the Washington State Climatologist website, and I encourage you to go and play with it yourself and look at how the climate has changed in the Pacific Northwest over the 20th century. And taking those dots and putting it into a graph form, we get something like this. This is the temperature record in Oregon averaged over the last century. This is from NOAA's website. And the green line is just the trend line. But you can see there's variability from year to year. And we have things like warm winters like we've had this year or dry winters like we've had this year. Or we have cold winters and very wet winters. But when we talk about climate change, we're talking about this overall direction of the trend. But precipitation's been a little bit of a different story. I can tell you that the Northwest has warmed unquestionably with those red dots that I showed you. But when you look at precipitation, the blue shows a wetter station, the red shows a drier station, and the yellow shows no change. And it's not that dominant trend that we saw in the last map. Our precipitation here, especially in Oregon, is dominated by interannual variability. We hear a lot about El Nino, La Nina, and the way it affects our winters. So when we talk about climate change, you know, temperature, we're pretty confident that we could say it's warmed, but precipitation, there's no real trend here. And when we talk about the future, we use global climate models. We have one Earth, and we're performing an experiment on it right now. So we have to create our Earth in a computer. And the way that we're pretty sure that our Earth in the computer is working well is that we take the model and we run it for the 20th century, for the years that we do have observations. That's the black line. Sounds like a monster. So when we run the model, and let's just run the model without human CO2 in there. Let's just have volcanic eruptions, solar cycles. Let's see what the model does. It produces that blue right there, which doesn't match up very well with the black at all. So then we add in the human-caused CO2, and then we say, model, run for the 20th century and show me what you would have. And it matches up with the observations. Natural processes do not account for the warming after the 1960s. In the globe, and scientists are extremely confident saying that. Oh, wow. Out of control. Sneak preview. In the Pacific Northwest, then we take our climate models and we say, okay, what might the Pacific Northwest look like in the future? And the next set of slides I'm going to show you are from the Oregon Climate Assessment Report. When the legislature created the Oregon Climate Change Research Institute, they gave us a list of things that we had to do, and one of them was assess the climate every 2 years. So this was our first report in 2010. We have to do another one this year, but the first chapter focused on future climate in the Pacific Northwest. The top panel is temperature, and it shows the 20th century. The black line is the model average, and that's the model range. And then these are future projections of temperature. It looks like bacon, but what it is the red is a more greenhouse gas intensive scenario, and the yellow is a less greenhouse gas intensive scenario. So you can see that we can make changes and change our future. We are going to warm, but if we use less greenhouse gases, we could only have a few degrees Fahrenheit warming, as opposed to this worst case scenario of almost 9 degrees Fahrenheit. Again, with the precipitation, we don't really know how it will change in the future. There's this huge range. You know, some models are saying it could get drier, some are saying it could get wetter, but the average is saying maybe a 2% increase over the 21st century, and that's not really anything to worry about. But when you worry about precipitation or your water resource manager, you start to think about seasonal changes. This comes from John Abatzoglou's work at the University of Idaho, and it talks about how Boise in the summer could be a lot more like these places here, like Fresno and Las Vegas and Central Valley of California in the future. In the 2090s, an average T-max of 98 degrees Fahrenheit. Wow, sorry. This is out of control. And also with warmer days, we're also projecting fewer cold nights in the future. The left panel is the historical. It shows days with the T-min below 0 degrees Celsius or 32 degrees Fahrenheit. And you can see we have a fair number here in Central Oregon, from about 150 to 200. But in the future, as far as A1B, that's just the more greenhouse gas intensive scenario, 2081 to 2100, what we call the end of the century in climate world. And you can see there's much less cold nights projected. But when I talked about the precipitation and I alluded to something like, you know, annual precipitation doesn't mean much, but seasonal changes would, and extreme precipitation, if you spend any time in the Willamette Valley, you know that we had a lot of flooding last month because of an extreme precipitation event. This shows the change in extreme precipitation events in November and December. And you can see up here in Oregon, the blue is a significant positive trend, the bigger blue dots, and the smaller blue dots are a positive trend, but it's not statistically significant. So we have seen an increase in extreme precipitation events, and those are the things that really cause damage. And our climate models are showing seasonal changes in precipitation, more warming and actually a drier summer. And I know that you think that the summers are already dry, but they'll get even a little bit drier with the likelihood of more extreme precipitation. The dry summers are problematic because we need that little bit extra rain to recharge the streams in the summer, so that could change stream flows a bit, as well as melting snowpacks or rain falling. Snow falling is rain in the winter. And Oregon's greenhouse gas emissions are a little bit different than the rest of the states. Transportation's our biggest wedge, and most states have electricity as their biggest wedge. And that's in part because we get a lot of electricity from hydropower, which is zero greenhouse gas emissions. So we're doing pretty good there. But our state is so big that we have to drive a lot of places to get to where we're going. I drove here from Corvallis. So that's probably our biggest source of greenhouse gas emissions. Agriculture contributes some, and these other smaller things, waste and wastewater, other industrial. And one of our biggest concerns in a warming climate is less mountain snowpack. I'm sure you know that mountain snowpack is so crucial here in Oregon for our water resources and for our enjoyment, for skiing and snowshoeing and all sorts of fun things. But the red shows a decline in mountain snowpack, change from the historical through the mid-21st century, almost an entire decline across Oregon, Washington, the Sierras, and over here in the Snake River Basin. So this is probably one of our biggest climate-related concerns, and the state is already thinking about how to adapt to this. And this is just another graphic. This isn't from our report. This is from the Washington Climate Assessment Report. They did one the year before us. This is from Ingrid Tover and Alan Hamlet's work. And it's just showing the way that river basins look now. The red are transition basins, the green are rain-dominant basins, and the blue are snow-dominant basins. This is the more greenhouse gas-intensive scenario, and this is the less greenhouse gas-intensive scenario. And as we move through the 21st century, you can see that much of Oregon becomes rain-dominant, except for this little bit over here by model projections. And it's only slightly better in the less greenhouse gas intensive scenario. Stream flows may change. I promised to focus on Central Oregon in this talk, but this graph of the Willamette River at the Columbia shows the changes in stream flow really well, so I used it. This goes from water year start, so this is October 1st, and this goes through September, and the blue is what the stream flows in the Willamette look like right now. It's kind of this gentle hump, and then this decline through summer. Whereas in the future, we would expect to see this peak here in early winter, earlier spring snowmelt, and it kind of drop quicker in late spring, early summer than it would in the future. And this is significant for hydropower, for salmon, and ecology, and just the general way of the river. And a lot of sites around Oregon that are snowmelt dominated show this sort of thing in the models. And there will certainly be impacts to agriculture, and it's a huge, huge part of our economy, so we're very concerned about how climate may change this. It's a $5 billion business, and agriculture kind of gets hit from a few different angles, in part because of the water availability, but also the temperatures may impact the dairy industry. But there are some positives, and when we took this to the legislature, we did highlight the positives. Crops like CO2, they might grow better. We might be able to grow crops that we couldn't grow before, and we might have a longer growing season with a warmer climate. Let me skip over that. And this is an incredibly popular graphic because it shows wine grapes and what climate they grow in. And right up there, the Pinot Noir grape is what Oregon grows really well, and it's in the 14 to 16 degrees Celsius range. But as we warm, we might be able to grow these California varieties while California grows raisins. So Oregon may be a winner. Vegetation certainly will grow in different places and be supported in different places in a warmer climate. The top is what the state looks like now. This is the historical. We have forest here on the west side. You have tundra up in the High Cascades, some shrubland over here. But in the future, less greenhouse gas, again, more greenhouse gases. You start to see the subtropical mixed forest move into the coast. And over here, it's striking that most of the maritime evergreen needleleaf forest can't be supported in western Oregon. And the state looks pretty homogenous by the end of the century. And that doesn't necessarily mean that the plants that are here now will just go away and these will take over. But these are the type of plants that will be supported in a warmer climate. And it doesn't take a PhD to say that a warmer, drier summer might cause more wildfires, and that's what the climate models are also projecting. Again, the less greenhouse gas intensive scenario means better news. The red shows more wildfire, more biomass burned, but the more greenhouse gas intensive scenario shows more wildfire in western Oregon, which is certainly problematic, especially in the urban wildland interface. And again, this is from John Obotsko at the University of Idaho, and it just shows the increased fire potential, but it breaks it down by 1.5 month time span. So down here in the desert southwest, their potential increases, but then by late summer up here in Oregon in early summer, it starts to creep in there. And actually early in fall, we start to see the change of more fire potential. And these shaded areas show where 2/3 models agree. So he didn't just pick out his favorite models and put them on there. They're having fun over there. And observe species changes. We are seeing species changes now. It could be natural variability or climate change, but it could be a proxy for how animals may act in a warmer climate. And we are seeing insects moving in from the south, both pests and other types of invasive diseases as well. Frogs are reproducing earlier in the year, which is temperature related. Land birds are coming up from the south, and freshwater fish are losing habitats because they're not having that cold water refugia. And this last one, Humboldt squid are appearing off the Oregon coast. This is recent, and we can't say if this is a climate change impact or not. They haven't been spotted in the past 2 years, but the water's been a little bit cooler because it's La Nina year, 2 La Nina years in a row. But Humboldt squid may be able to be supported off the Oregon coast in a warmer climate. Key findings that we took to the legislature. It's a 435-page report. It's on our website. Don't read the whole thing. There's summaries, but they wanted 2 pages. So these are the 2 pages we gave them. It was a lot of work to write 435 pages into 2 pages. A lot of margins and font sizing. But increases in annual temperature and warmer, drier summers with summer water supply will decrease because of the reduced snowpack and the drier summers. We just point out that our most greenhouse gas intensive sector is transportation. Our goal in the Institute is to just provide the best available science. We can't and we don't tell the legislature what to do about emissions. Availability, quality, and cost of water will be a limiting factor in many sectors. There will be potential opportunities in the ag sector. We might get some great new wines, longer growing season. We might win there. Wildfire is projected to increase, and frequency and magnitude of coastal flooding events may increase. I cut out all those slides because we're pretty far from the coast here. And many plant and animal species on land, freshwater, and sea will shift their distributions. They'll either go deeper in sea or up in latitude or upslope where it's cooler. And we are seeing changes to the marine environment right now, including increased temperatures and changes in ocean chemistry. The Pacific Northwest is kind of a hotbed for ocean acidification right now, and it's really impacting our shellfish hatcheries. So given every depressing thing that I just told you, minus the wine, you know, what do we do about it? Do we go home at night and just drink our new wine varieties, or do we start to think about how we're going to live in this new world? And I'm going to talk a little bit about adaptation and the difference between adaptation and mitigation, because sometimes they get mixed up. Adaptation is just building resiliency to the climate impacts. Mitigation is reducing greenhouse gas emissions to lessen some of those climate impacts. We don't work on mitigation. There is an arm, the Oregon Global Warming Commission, does work on mitigation and reducing emissions, but we work a little bit on adaptation with the states. So I worked a lot with the Oregon state agencies on preparing adaptation at the state level. And back in 2004, they had convened a group, the Governor's Climate Change Integration Group, and started to think about, we're going to live in this warmer climate. How are we going to deal with this as a state? In 2009, Governor Kulongoski then asked us to get together and work on an integrated plan with all the state agencies working together. And if you know state agencies, that was a challenge within itself, but it was a really, really positive process. And write an adaptation framework plan just to start thinking about how we're going to adapt to climate change. We used a three-tiered structure. We had the governor's office at the top, people like me, the staff level people who did all the work at the bottom, and our bosses at the middle, but there was a lot of data exchange through the three tiers. So not one tier was controlling the whole framework. But budget challenges changed the path slightly, as budget challenges often do, and we all know that we're in a really tough budget crisis. We had to leverage existing capacity and look at short-term actions at low cost. We weren't going to be given millions of dollars to throw money at a problem, and we weren't going to come up with solutions that said, okay, in 50 years we'll spend millions of dollars, because who knows what the budget will look like then. So what were we trying to do is identify people and communities and infrastructure and resources that are at risk from future effects of climate. And fortuitously, we were writing the report that I just showed all the slides from at the same time that the governor put out this memo. They asked for a draft, and I said no. We wanted to put it through peer review first, so instead they got me. So I went to Salem every week, and I talked to them about climate impacts and the ones that they should focus on maybe a little more than others. Water rose to the top, but we wouldn't worry about something like hurricanes increasing in Oregon, so we'd cut out those. And what we did is we put it on a confidence and consequence matrix. Confidence was the scientific confidence. We do have greater scientific confidence in some things than others. And the consequence, how bad would it be if this happened? And what we did is we developed the science to management interface, or as a lot of people call it, connecting science and policy. And these are the risks that we came forth with and that the adaptation plan is based around: increase in temperatures, changes in hydrology, wildfires, ocean temperatures, a lot of what I went over before, coastal erosion, species and habitats, increases in disease and invasive pests, loss of wetland ecosystems, I didn't talk too much about that, and increased frequency of extreme precipitation events and floods. I took these slides from Jeff Weber. I should give him credit. He's with the Department of Land Conservation and Development. And the Department of Land Conservation and Development was a really good lead for this exercise, because good land use planning is already a climate adaptation. And you know Oregon's land use laws are very strict. But we've been dealing with extreme weather throughout time, and actually one of the deadliest disasters in the U.S., as well as the deadliest disaster in Oregon, was the Heppner Flash Flood in 1903. And this is surprising to some people that this happened, because it is on that drier side of the state that I talked about. It's in north central Oregon. But this flash flood along Willow Creek on June 14th, it was a convective event, a thunderstorm event, after a really dry spring. So the ground wasn't ready to get a ton of rain all at once. And it was only 15 minutes between rainfall and crest. 243 people died in this, and it's the third deadliest flash flood in the US. The first was Johnstown, and the second was Rapid City, South Dakota. And now we're thinking about the climate, and what are we going to do about this winter? The top panel, lots of sun is fun, but where's the snow? I took from an article from KTVZ in early December, and then in mid-January, Mount Bachelor celebrates the Ruse massive snowfall that temporarily shut down the resort. So it's been a little bit of be careful what you wish for. Mount Bachelor, I guess, is only shut down twice in 20 years because of too much snow, but they got 74 inches in 72 hours. And now you know it hasn't really been snowing except for the past weekend. So it's been an extremely strange winter. And we're on the drought monitor now, and in a La Nina year, which normally means cooler and wetter in the Pacific Northwest, I kind of push all my drought emails aside, except for this year, because it's something that we actually have to consider worrying about. The yellow and the brown show abnormally dry and moderate drought, and we see that moderate drought start to creep into central Oregon, and I'm sure you've noticed that it's been much drier than normal here. And this was the snowpack at the beginning of the month. It's below average across the entire state. We do have some time to make this up, but we're getting really close to crunch time. We need to get some serious snow in the mountains now. But you may remember last year, it was again a atypical situation. It was a La Nina year. We didn't have a lot of snow in the mountains. Snowpack was below normal. This was February 3rd, 2011. And then, I cut one of my slides out, but we did turn the snowpack around and had above average snowpack, a very cold and wet spring, which I'm sure you can remember. I got a lot of angry calls from people, as if I could change it. Green tomatoes and rainy picnics and always interesting. But our seasonal forecast shows, this is from NOAA's Climate Prediction Center. It's a 3-month outlook, and it just shows which way the odds are tilted. So it doesn't mean it's going to happen, but the odds are tilted towards cooler temperatures here in central and western Oregon, and above average precipitation in February, March, April. So that's good news for our snowpack at least, but bad news if you don't like the cold. Just a one slide about what we've got going on at OSU. We are Oregon's Climate Knowledge Network. The Oregon Climate Change Research Institute was formed with House Bill 3543 in the 2007 legislature. The Oregon Climate Service is the state climate office. It's been around for decades. I know a few of you know George Taylor. He used to run that. The Climate Impacts Research Consortium, CIRC, is the NOAA-funded regional integrated sciences and assessment, so we focus on the whole Pacific Northwest. And we are the Northwest Department of Interior Climate Science Center as well. So we've got a lot going on, and they all stack up on top of each other, and it keeps things very interesting. And I am happy to take any questions, comments, discussions. There's my email if you don't want to say anything out loud. And please visit our websites, and I do tweet about the weather if you tweet. And thank you.
So if you have questions, please raise your hand, and I will do my best to Phil Donahue to you. And we'll go to the back.
Yeah, I really can't see back there. So.
It's all right. We'll bring those house lights up here shortly. And just put it right into your face.
Yeah, hello. When you do your projections or did your projections, did you look at the possibility of extreme methane release up in the Arctic tundra and what that might cause?
That's a good question. There's a lot of work going on right now about the climate sensitivity, and if something really bad like that happened or the atmosphere didn't react to CO2 the way we think it would and just went haywire, that the future could look a lot different than we're projecting right now. So that's an ongoing area of study, but it didn't make it into our report.
Other questions?
Thinking about your projection that we have wetter but warmer winters, less snowpack, and thinking about what we can do to mitigate that, I guess, which is not your area, but it seems to me the obvious thing is more reservoirs, which is clearly not something that we want. We as a people right now are trying to get rid of dams, but it seems to me the only solution is to have more dams. Is there something I'm missing?
It might not be dams. One of the projects we are working on focuses on the Willamette River Valley, but it looks at water scarcity in the future. And a lot of people are looking into things like aquifer recharge, pumping water underground into places where we can put it, more reservoirs, maybe not damming rivers, but figuring out ways to store water. It will have to be a man-made storage solution in some areas because our natural capacity is declining. Dams are controversial because they limit salmon runs and stuff, so I think it would have to be a better solution that wouldn't harm the ecosystem while retaining water. So it's a challenge, but I think it's the one that's at the top of the list to work on.
Kathy, I married a woman who grew up in Bend, and her father says that there are very few clear days in Bend like there used to be, that the high clouds, that the water vapor, you know, seems to be increased. Do you look at that in your modeling? Does your model talk about cloud cover as a possible mitigating factor for temperature increases, anything like that?
Well, water vapor is a greenhouse gas in itself, but clouds may cool a little bit, but it won't be enough to offset the overall warming. So water vapor emissions from something like cars is bad, but clouds may cool, and I know it's confusing, but...
Are there more clouds? Do we know?
I don't know. Clouds are very small, and model grids are pretty coarse. I've heard anecdotes from people, and I'm not denying their claims or their perceptions.
Other questions? Surely there are others. Yes, sir.
I can see you. Everyone else is dark.
Some people say that, I understand what you were explaining earlier, climate versus weather,
yes.
But is there some statistic that's tracked variability over time, and is there an increase in variability like over time, or can that be made a statistic, and does that relate to any increases in temperature?
We don't have a good handle on the change in variability yet. Are you talking like El Nino and La Nina and interannual variability?
You know, this sense that we're on sort of this roller coaster of weather, really hot, really cold, really rainy, really dry, does that relate to a climate pattern, or is that, or not?
It may. The answer is that in a future climate, we would expect more extreme weather, but we can't pin down the extremes right now to climate change without an attribution study. There has been an increase in some extremes in the country, extreme precip here, but it's tough with things like tornadoes and other extremes because we just don't have the record.
Yep. Coming.
I've been hearing recently about the proposal in Congress to increase the forestation cutting timber, excuse me, in Oregon, 10 million, whatever it is, board feet or acres or whatever it is, but it's a whole lot of cutting that we haven't had for some time. What impact will that have on our climate,
well,
or any?
Trees are a carbon sink. They take some of our carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. It would maybe have an effect on transpiration. These are just speculation type things. I don't know a direct impact, but certainly altering the ecosystem does change the climate.
I have a big garden, and I was happy to hear your
Did you call me?
Anyway, I'm glad to hear there are going to be warmer nights because that's been a problem for gardens around here for a long time. Can I also expect not to have a frost every month?
I would hope not, but I can't say.
See another, yep.
So at the state level, how much resistance are you getting from naysayers? Seems like there's a group out there that doesn't believe there is climate change.
There is some resistance. And there is a group out there that doesn't believe that there is climate change. We certainly get resistance from people, just general people. The government, the legislature hasn't given us much pushback. They did form us and ask us to study climate. We don't make policy recommendations, we just provide the science. So maybe we're a little bit more palatable to the legislature, but certainly the scientific consensus shows that scientists believe that humans are changing the climate, and there's a gap in public perception which we need to work on.
I'm double dipping tonight, and I just came over from the Kathleen Dean Moore's talk.
Oh, good.
And Tim McMenamin's on essentially the same topic, but from a moral or philosophical perspective. So I encourage everybody to go home and read Kathleen Dean Moore. She has some really creative, innovative stuff about how to deal with this moral dilemma and why it's a moral dilemma. But I mean, the facts are great too. Can you tell me more about ocean acidification? Somehow, living here in Central Oregon, it's just never gotten through to me what's going on out there. And
yeah, it's interesting because it's, again, one of those things where it's pulling the carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, which is a good thing. It may have reduced the warming by a significant percentage, but it's putting it into the oceans, and it dissolves into the oceans. So when carbon dioxide dissolves into oceans, it makes the water more acidic, which it's measurable, and they've had the closed shellfish hatcheries, and there's been quite a few studies on oyster shells not being able to calcify because of this acidic water. Ocean acidification is, you know, one of the parts. There's also extreme wave heights and storm surges, and the ocean is a very dynamic place, and its climate change is affecting it vastly. And I second your motion to read Kathleen's book. It's fantastic. It's escaping me right now, but if you just Google her name, it's on her OSU website. She's a professor at OSU.
Kathy, I'm curious. The modeling that you've done, does it look at the watershed level and take into consideration some of the geologic factors? The Deschutes Basin is a very diverse place. If you look to the west side of the Deschutes Basin, the volcanic structure of the geography and geology produces much more in the way of spring-fed streams and rivers, whereas on the east side of this basin, we've got a much more snowmelt-driven system. Do your projections take into account those geologic changes, hydrologic changes?
That's an excellent question. It's almost like I told you to ask it, which I didn't tell him to ask it, but I didn't show the hydrograph for the Deschutes because of that exact thing. Hydrologic models are terrible at groundwater-fed systems like the Deschutes with volcanics, and there's a huge need for modeling at the watershed level. It's probably the question we get asked the most is, how is climate going to change in my watershed? Global climate models are big. We're making advances in regional climate modeling. It's kind of like a car. It gets a little bit better every year. But we're not quite there with someplace like the Deschutes. So we can tell you general changes, but not specific point changes.
All the way to the back again.
Working off the paella.
Yeah, since you're... models really don't look at the extreme events that, you know, if it goes out of whack, as you mentioned. When you look at adaptability and resilience, did you look at any of those possibilities where it could get more extreme than what your models are showing?
Yeah. Right now, the adaptation... climate adaptation is kind of a newer topic because we came to this realization that we're going to have to live in this world, and people started thinking about it. So the framework is very young, and it has a few more iterations to go through, but it's built in the capacity to think about very extreme events. Right now, it just talks about leveraging existing capacity within the state. But it's left open the possibility of big extreme events, especially flooding type events, the floods that we had in Philomath and Corvallis, the Vernonia flood a few years ago, and the flood that I-5 was underwater in Washington a few years ago, were kind of the benchmark type events. If we keep having these in a warmer climate, how are we going to deal with it?
Do you have with the ones that do not believe man-made climate change, is there any discussion as far as how much is on it's just a global warming trend that has been occurring over millions of years versus man-made?
Yes. The CO2 levels are at the highest they've ever been in the past 60,000 years. And also, we haven't seen, our climate has changed throughout the history of the world. There's no denying that. But the rate of change in the last 50 years that we've seen hasn't happened in Earth's climate ever. I mean, the climate changes have happened over thousands of years in the past. Also, when you look at greenhouse gas additions to the atmosphere plus, you know, the temperature record and loss of snow cover and sea level rise, it's to me, it's without a doubt that humans are changing the climate, and scientists agree.
If we were to consider the time for any mitigation to actually impact climate change, CO2, and the like, what's the risk that we may have passed a tipping point and that we're in a feedback loop with events in the Arctic and the like overwhelming the possibility that we can do anything about it?
Overwhelming is a good word because sometimes it feels overwhelming. We've already bought into a certain amount of warming. If we stopped using greenhouse gases as a world tomorrow, we would still warm a little bit because of the life of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. We aren't at the point, though, where it's hopeless yet. I showed the temperature projections in the range where, you know, a few degrees might happen, but we could have that 9 degrees. So there's certainly time for action, and if we were to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions, we could make a change.
Anyone else? Yes.
Thanks. Going back to the Deschutes groundwater system, would it make sense that if we have reduced snowpacks, that over time at least the groundwater, the amount of groundwater would have to be reduced, and that if we had rain over snow events, that a lot of that is just going to wash down to the Columbia River rather than go into the groundwater?
Yeah, there's a few people in Portland who work on climate change and groundwater, and it's exactly, what you said, washing out earlier in the winter, not recharging. It's a concern, and I could read up a little bit more on it myself.
All right, any other questions? Maybe. Yeah, sure.
Sorry, I'm going to ask two here. So I drive a Prius, and I'm really happy to do that. But I also realize it's totally futile, that there's absolutely nothing we can do in this state that will in any way, shape, or form stop the growth or the increase of CO2 in our atmosphere. China, India, Brazil, emerging markets are going to guarantee that we will have a warming future. So this idea of thinking about a lower CO2 world, to me, seems futile. The only thing we can be doing is think about how do we live in a changed environment. And I'm wondering, you know, what is going on in the state to really deal with the reality that is going to happen?
Good point. We're in Oregon. We use very little greenhouse gases compared to the rest of the world. We have China and India. If China builds a coal-fired power plant every day, like they happen, or every week, or whatever the statistic is, which is terrifying, we can't stop it here in Oregon. That's why we have shifted a lot of our focus to adaptation. And the plan that I briefly spoke about is probably where the state's putting a lot of its efforts. But that's not to say that driving your Prius is futile. If we ever did come up with a national strategy or a global strategy and we had to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions, you're already used to the lifestyle. In Oregon, we might be better poised to adapt a less greenhouse gas intensive lifestyle than somewhere like India or China. So it's not for naught. you're doing a very good thing.
Maybe next year we'll talk about the impact of increase in beer consumption related to water. Let's thank Kathy Dello tonight for coming. Thanks, Kathy.
Thank you.
And thank all of you. We really appreciate you coming out and supporting the Land Trust and our efforts to just educate on a variety of topics and engage the community on things that affect us all. So again, March 20th, right here, we'll be with Ellen Bishop Morris talking about the geologic history of Wyshoose Creek.